dear listeners, my name is Olga Lukina. I'm a board-certified behavior analyst and certified occupational therapist. The main goal of this podcast is to inform families who are children with autism, as well as specialist teachers and other interested listeners about the difficulties in scientifically approved interventions to improve the quality of life of people with autism. Today we will have a conversation on the topic, the role of the Early Start Denver Model in Child Development, with a board-certified behavior analyst, Melissa Melo. Welcome to episode 8. Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for attending my podcast. Let's discuss today's topic, the role of the Early Start Denver Model in Child Development. I'm always interested in hearing people's stories, so I would appreciate if you could share more information about yourself and areas of interest in applied behavior analysis and autism.
Yes, sounds good. And thank you so much for having me. And it's so nice to see you again after all this time. It's wonderful. So I started in the field many, many years ago as a special education teacher. And was working in a non-public school with children with autism who were very affected. It was a wonderful job. It drew me into the field, got me totally hooked on working with children with autism. But it was very, very, very challenging. And after working there for about 5 years, I found the world of early intervention and was just enamored with working with very young children and seeing the progress that they could make and how much change was possible in those early years, and really just never turned back once I joined the world of early intervention. And it was a big difference from having chairs thrown at me to working with a two-year-old. So was really hooked on just seeing the language progression and just seeing how much change is possible in those first 5 years, which then from there was kind of my draw to the Early Start Denver model, which was, when I found it at the time, one of the only approaches I knew about that was really tailored to working with young children of that age. Other methods and interventions were applicable for children that age, but the ESDM was the first one I found that was really tailored for that young age. And I thought that was really interesting and exciting, and was really into learning about that. So I guess my interests are early intervention, and I just finished dissertation work on the inequities and disparities that exist in autism treatment. And so that's something I'm interested in as of late as well, just seeing what we can do to normalize and equalize the field so that all children are getting the intervention that they need.
So my first question is, why the Early Start Denver model? Why did you choose it?
Yeah, kind of like I said, well, in a way, the ESDM chose me. So I was working at a clinic in the Bay Area, California, that was, like I said, doing early intervention. So we were working with children with a diagnosis under the age of 5. And we were just starting this clinic and looking for models that supported intervention for this young age. And we actually, through that search, found the Mind Institute, which was in Sacramento, so about an hour from where I was living, and contacted Dr. Sally Rogers to see if she would be willing to train us. And she was, so she came to our clinic and trained me and a couple more of our staff in the model. And from that moment on, we were, you know, none of us, I think, turned back. We were all pretty enamored with the model and seeing what it could do for young ones and just the way that it promotes interaction with very young children with autism. I think we were all, it just kind of felt right for us, for our team. The approach and the way that it says, you know, play with young children, which just felt so like a sigh of relief, you know, oh my gosh, we get to play with young children. That feels like exactly what we should be doing. So it was really the theories of the model that allow you to interact with a young child in the way we're meant to be interacting with young children that kind of sold us on the model.
That's great. I am always jealous when I listen to the person who has an opportunity to get PhD in applied behavior analysis. We don't have this opportunity in our country, so you are a lucky one. My next question, why a parent or a specialist should choose the ESDM as a therapeutic approach for children with autism?
Great question. So I want to start by sharing that the ESDM is not the only approach to intervention for a child with autism, and it isn't necessarily the only approach that someone should choose for a child with autism. ESDM does have a lot of research to support the efficacy of the model. It does have a strong research rigor. So there's a lot of randomized controlled trials, which is kind of the gold standard in research. So there's a lot of reasons to pick the model if you're looking for something that is evidence-based and has been shown to work with young children. Outside of that, I think the reasons for leaning towards the ESDM over a different approach is that the child shows some ability to learn from the natural environment, and maybe shows some resistance to working in the more rigid structure of discrete trial teaching. So some children have a big aversion to sitting at a chair and receiving instruction in this more directive sort of way. And so when that's the case, I think it's really nice that we have an alternative type of intervention to offer. But I want to caveat that I think discrete trial teaching has had some really positive impacts on many children. And I don't think that as a standalone, it's not a good intervention. I think it can be a great intervention, but I think it's really important to recognize that not all children are going to benefit from just one thing. So in that same line, not every child is going to make progress in the ESDM, and not every child is going to make progress using discrete trial teaching. So it's important that we have a range of different interventions that we can offer, and that those interventions can be flexible to see if a child is not making progress, what do we change to ensure that they're progressing. So I think, again, reasons to pick the ESDM, perhaps a more naturalistic type of intervention seems like it's going to be the right approach for the child. The child shows some resistance to learning in the more structured fashion of discrete trial teaching. They show an interest in toys and materials and the types of items that a young child is generally drawn to. And maybe just for the therapist, it feels like an approach that they believe in, which can make a really big difference for the child outcome if you feel really passionate and strongly about what you're doing.
When I use ESDM in my practice, sometimes it is great to use for 2-3 years old, but sometimes it feels like when you work with older children, you want a little bit more structure in teaching. So do you find it is important to mix ESDM with other ABA teaching strategies?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So it's a good point that the ESDM is really for young ages. We generally stop using the ESDM around age 5 and then transition to a different type of intervention. It's really a specialized approach for young children with ASD. And after they age out or turn 5, we generally recommend either transitioning into PRT or discrete trial teaching. Sort of depends on what's available in the communities for the children. I don't necessarily recommend a blended approach. I think the research actually shows that using an intervention as intended is where we tend to see progress. But sometimes, like the ESDM is a good example of this, the model actually calls for knowing both types of interventions. And when a child isn't making progress using the ESDM as intended, we move them to what we call the decision tree. And that tree guides us in how to change the program if the child isn't making progress on a particular goal. And we actually would then move that goal, if it's not making progress, into a more structured format. But I still don't really think of that as blended. I think of it as we're doing the ESDM, but we're teaching this one goal in a more structured way until we see the child start to make progress. And then we'll try and reduce that structure and go back to the ESDM as intended.
Sometimes for observers, it is hard to see the difference between ABA and ESDM. So what is the main difference between these two?
Yes, I'll start with just a little, kind of almost backing up for a second. So it's important to think of ABA as a more, well, let me just acronyms for families. So that's applied behavior analysis. But thinking of that as really an umbrella term. So applied behavior analysis is more the science of learning. And then these methods or models that we have are the different approaches that we take to apply that science of learning. So thinking of ESDM actually as under that umbrella of applied behavior analysis, because that's where we pull all of the parts of how we teach a child, that all comes from ABA. So all of these techniques that we're using, prompting, chaining, fading, behavior reduction strategies, extinction, all of these things come from the science of ABA, and they're infused into the practice of ESDM. And so we can think again of this like continuum where there's more structured teaching methods under this umbrella, like discrete trial teaching, and then moving maybe on the other side of the continuum into the world of what we call NDBIs, or naturalistic developmental behavioral interventions. And so the NDBI world tends to use more the theories of child development. So these approaches looked at how are neurotypically developing children learning, and can we emulate that in ASD and make sure that we're considering the stages and the development of the typically developing child, and then try to walk our children with ASD through those stages. Where and the approach is, again, much more play-based, much more naturalistic. It really looks like a fun intervention. If you weren't sure how to tell about goals and the ways that teaching is occurring, it might look like the adult is just having a really fun time with the child. They're engaged in play. Of course, once you understand what's happening, there's lots and lots of teaching going on inside of those episodes, but it could look just like an adult having a great time with a kid. Where the more structured approaches like discrete trial teaching also can look really fun, but it's a little more apparent, I think, that a child is engaged in a therapeutic sort of session. They're usually both seated, generally at like a child-sized table, and the instruction is happening more clearly, I guess. Where in the ESDM, we're trying to embed learning opportunities inside of play, inside of this kind of natural learning. In discrete trial teaching, it's really just that we've sort of decided that the child isn't learning very well from their natural environment. And so we need to make the learning much clearer. And so rather than teaching colors by putting shapes in a shape sorter and having the child identify the color that we're holding up and then we're going to put in, they might have individual cards with the different colors on them. And we're really working just on identifying those colors outside of the context of anything else. And so we're learning to name and label those colors, and we're doing it maybe a bit more repeated practice. And then once it's been accomplished in this one setting, then we might try to program in some generalization and see if we can start to name those same colors in other items and in other ways. But it's still relatively removed from this more natural sort of style of learning. So I think the biggest thing to consider is, how is the child learning? What seems to be their best way of kind of coming to understanding of these concepts? And that really should be what drives then the teaching approach.
Is it important to keep the structure of teaching using ESDM? For example, if we teach a child to discriminate body parts, we teach only three till they are mastered and then move to the next body part.
Yeah, I think it's an ideal situation, if I'm understanding the question correctly, that the therapist and the parent are in really close contact and communication, and that the parent knows exactly what's being worked on in therapy, so that if they have the time and the availability, they're able to teach what's taking place in therapy also at home. And we tend to have, just like you're describing, kind of a prescribed, you know, let's not start with every single body part because that might be overwhelming and we might not have great retention. So let's pick maybe the three most salient ones or relevant ones for the child and start there. And then let the parent know where we're working so they can be on board with their work with the child at home. And now we're really working as a team, and the child is getting generalization as part of their program. So then maybe they're working on those three in the clinic, and then also working on those three when they go home with the family. And that's going to lead to quicker learning of that skill. So yeah, and it doesn't mean that the parent, if they're inspired to work on a fourth body part, that they can't. But it's really nice when the parent knows what the therapy goals are, and we're working as a cohesive team to really practice the current steps so we can reach mastery sooner.
Is ESTM meant only for children with autism, or is it also useful for other diagnoses like Down syndrome, ADHD, or other developmental delays?
Yeah, really good question. So present moment, we only have research to suggest that the ESTM is effective with young children with autism. That doesn't mean necessarily that the strategies and the approach wouldn't be effective for young children with other types of neurodevelopmental delays. We just can't say that there's research to support that it is effective. We've had some momentum going with looking at the ESDM with children with Fragile X syndrome. And from what I recall, that was leading to really nice outcomes. It was looking like those children did show gains, just like we see in ASD with the ESDM. But our research thus far has been limited to just children with autism. And so because we're always thinking about evidence-based and being research supported, that's all we have evidence to say it's successful with at this moment, but no reason to believe it would be harmful or not effective with other types of children. But you know, it's an area we need to be investigating more. So I encourage others to take that data and get that started and see what we learn.
I have several questions about the therapy process. What does the process of assessing a child's skills look like?
So the ESDM, one thing that I love about this model is that it actually comes with a checklist that you can use every 3 months to assess the child's current skill level. So this checklist evaluates the child across all developmental domains, receptive and expressive language, fine and gross motor skills, play skills, imitation, personal independence, joint attention. And so we're assessing the child's skills across all of those domains and figuring out areas of strength for the child, as well as areas where we want to focus on and create those areas into the child's treatment goals. And this tool comes with a checklist, comes with a therapy book. So it's all part of like a package of this intervention, and it's just ready and available for you, which I love. And so we do the checklist when we first meet the child, and that's gonna become our treatment goals for the next 3 months of intervention for that child. And after those 3 months, hopefully we've achieved mastery on that first set of goals that we've written. And then we're gonna do that checklist again, reassess the child, determine where they've made progress and where they're still needing support, and develop the next 3 months of treatment goals for that particular child. And so it's kind of all part of this packaged intervention. And I really love that you don't have to try and figure out using some external source, using the VB map or something else, what are going to become the child's goals. It's just all available to you when you're using the ESDM.
Also, how does a specialist set goals for a child?
So we always write goals in every domain, even if the child is receiving 1 hour a week of intervention, we're still going to have at least one goal from every one of those domains. Using ESDM, it's considered working across all levels of child development. So we want to make sure that we are working across all levels of child development. So we're always going to have at least one goal from every domain. Generally, even if it's a low hours per week of teaching, we still have two receptive language goals and two expressive language goals. Because those can be relatively easily embedded into most activities that you're going to be working on. So I think that would be about the right place to be for a low number of treatment hours, maybe somewhere between 10 and 12 goals, which sounds like a lot if you think about 1 hour of treatment, but also once you're used to ESDM and understand how much teaching can occur inside a treatment session, you might actually end up deciding that you need more, because inside of one 7-minute activity, you can really hit many, many goals inside of that activity once you've learned and become proficient at using the ESDM. And then for kids who are having, you know, somewhere between 5, 10, 15, 20 hours of treatment a week, we would recommend increasing the number of goals that those children have, just so that we're making sure to make use of all of that treatment time and ensure that they're learning as much as possible inside of that treatment hour.
Sometimes it's tricky to hold all the goals in your head. Maybe you have some secrets of how to do this.
Yes, very tricky. That's one of the big challenges in ESDM for sure. It does get easier with practice, but when I was first starting, I used to do things like when a child was coming into the treatment session, I would use like big post-it notes or big poster boards and actually write their goals on those poster boards and hang them up on the wall. So as I was working with the child, I was able to just kind of quickly glance at my treatment room, and that would help me remember. I would also make kind of session plans, which is useful, but you have to be flexible because you may have written the best session plan in the world, and then the child walks in and they don't want to do anything that you've planned for them. So I would pretend, like, let's say the child walks in the room and picks blocks. Given all of the goals that they have, I would plan out, just kind of write out everything that I could then teach that child with those blocks. Do they have a pointing goal? Do they have a labeling colors goal? Do they have a using eye contact to request goal? So planning out all of the goals that I could target inside of that activity. And again, you have to be flexible. They're going to change the plan. It's not always going to work the way you intended. But that was a really helpful practice because then at least I was getting my brain used to thinking about how to embed their particular goals. And it really helped solidify for me what their treatment targets were. And that kind of helped put them in my memory. But it is tricky, and you do have to be a bit creative to find ways to remember all of the goals we're trying to embed. But nothing's more important, right? This is how we're getting the child to learn and grow and make progress. So it's worth the effort to figure out whatever system works for you to remember.
So what are the main ESDM teaching strategies specialists use to promote child's development?
Yeah, so in the ESDM, we use what we call joint activity routines. And that wouldn't mean too much to anyone outside of the world of intervention, but joint activity routines are like the framework for teaching inside of the ESDM. It's made up of four parts, which make a lot more sense when you can see therapy in action, but I'll describe them for you. So the first part is just the setup. So the ESDM, we consider a child-led type of intervention, but I hesitate sometimes when we say child-led because child-led doesn't mean that no matter what, we're following the child's lead into any type of activity or anything that they want to do. Child-led really means that, you know, you decide, the child gets some say in what activities we're going to be doing. But if the child has a difficult time making these choices or their play is very non-functional, the adult needs to be able to help guide that play into something that's going to be useful and turn into learning. So child-led to the extent that it's going to be fruitful for the child's learning experience. But the play usually begins by following the child into something that they're interested in. And like I said, if they have a difficult time making those choices or that's not quite where the child is yet, the adult might set up the room so that there's options available for the child and they're just kind of free flowing, looking at what might be most interesting to them. Or perhaps we present them with two different activities, the materials for those activities, and the child can point and show us which one of those two they're more interested in participating in. So ideally the child is helping to initiate or lead what activity we're going to join in. And there should be teaching happening even in this phase of the activity setup. So like I said, maybe we have two options out and they point to choose or they verbalize to choose. Or maybe they have a goal of initiating. So they initiate an activity. So always thinking about where we can embed learning in. The next phase that we set up that we move into is called the theme. So setup, then theme. And the theme is really just however the adult and the child first start using those materials. And so it can really be pretty simple. And again, should be taken from how the child is wanting to use those materials. So let's just say they picked like a train track or a train set. And maybe the first thing that the child wants to do is start to set up the tracks so that we can build something for the train. So that's our theme. The theme is just kind of setting up tracks, getting ready to play with the train. Maybe we've made our setup and the first thing the child wants to do with the trains is just drive them on the tracks. Great, that's our theme. We just set up the tracks and now we're driving the train. And inside of that theme, we should be, now we're really into the teaching. And teaching is where we're going to start to incorporate all of those theories, all of those ideas that we take from applied behavior analysis. So maybe we want to ask the child, is this train big or small? Maybe that's one of the child's goals. And if the child has a difficult time answering that question, we're going to use some of those strategies. So we might, that was a bad example because it's very hard to prompt language, but we might repeat that and say big or small. And then if the child still doesn't respond, maybe we offer just a model, big, and see if the child will say big. And once they say big, we're going to reinforce that by saying, yeah, big, and then hand them that train. So they're going to get that item. And that's the reinforcer. And that's what makes it a naturalistic intervention, or at least part of it. So rather than receiving an external reward, like a piece of candy for talking about the size of the train, they're going to get the train because that's what's related to what we're doing right now. So those were two examples of using prompting and reinforcement inside of our teaching. We also want the teaching to be set up really clearly. So we call these chains the ABC chains, using an antecedent behavior and a consequence, which really just means that we've set up a clear instruction. So in that example, is this train big or small? That's our instruction. It's our cue for the child to respond to something. The next piece is the behavior, which is a response that we're looking for from the child. So correct or incorrect. Did they say the correct size for this train? And that dictates our consequence. So if it was a big train and the child says big, then we're going to celebrate that. So big. Awesome. Yes, that's the big train. Here you go. They're going to get the train and they're going to drive it on the track. Maybe they didn't respond or they said small. We're going to try and correct that gently because they're young and they're learning. These are brand new concepts. So maybe they say small and we might just, you know, look at it and go, big, you know, try and just kind of like gently let them know that we want to see a different response, but we're being really kind and supportive inside of that as we help and support their learning. So kind of getting into the meat of how we teach, but this is really where all of those principles from ABA come in. So then we move to the part called variation, which is my favorite piece. Children with ASD can become very rigid and inflexible and have a hard time thinking about how to do an activity differently. So a lot of kids have, whether it be a social activity or an object activity, this is the way it's done. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard for them to think about that activity in any other type of way. And so we want to make sure that we're always working on that flexibility piece and showing the child, even if it's brief in the beginning, how this activity can be worked on a little bit differently. So we're just showing a slightly different idea that the child can learn to incorporate into their play. So if it was like driving trains on the tracks, it might be for some children, even as simple as driving the train on the floor and not on the track, or using the trains in a totally different way. Maybe we're trying to teach imitation and we start clapping the trains together or using the trains as drumsticks on a drum. It's really endless and it's really driven by the child and what they're going to be able to, like, what is their next level that they could kind of understand as we show these variations. So I can't really give specifics, but we're really just trying to do something different with the activity and continue to embed new learning opportunities, because the theme can, after a while, start to get a little redundant, maybe, or boring, or we feel there's this feeling as the teacher that something needs to change. And that's what the variations offer us and helps to work on that rigid behavior. And then we move to the closure, which is where we clean up the activity. This is often a really good time to have children work on their cognitive goals. So we might sort the trains into one bin and the train tracks into another bin. So a really nice natural opportunity for some of those cognitive goals. It is really important that we clean up the activities. It helps children with just the sense of time and closure and the understanding that one thing is done and now we're moving to the next. And that's kind of like how we wrap up and close an activity and then move into the next setup for the next joint activity routine. And inside the ESDM, we're working on two different types of joint activity routine, one with objects. So that's like the train and the tracks that I just described. And the other one we call a sensory social routine, and that's where we work on everything really without objects, helping children with autism understand and become comfortable inside of the social world. So these we're thinking about songs, tickle games, chase games, hide and seek, peekaboo, tickles, being thrown up in the air, all those types of things that we do with young children without any objects. And same idea there, we work on a setup, theme, variation, and closure. But the idea is that we want to work between these two because most children with autism have a preference for one or the other. So they're really comfortable in the object world and not that comfortable socially. Or the other way can be true too, where children just love interacting with people but don't really understand objects and how to use them. So we want to make sure that we're working on both so that we help children with their challenge areas. But also we have this kind of more comfortable place to come back to so that the whole hour of intervention isn't just challenging, but we're working on both areas.
So how do you manage the situations if a child engages in stereotypy and it is hard to transition to the play?
Really great question, and it's challenging. But like I said, we want to, at the very start of therapy, join the child where they are. One of the therapy techniques that we use in ESDM that helps us kind of get into this place where we're doing this intensive teaching is really beginning intervention just as someone who we can show the child is safe and comfortable to be around. So sometimes early on in therapy, we might be really just joining the child exactly where they are. And if engaging in stereotypy is kind of their comfort zone, we might spend a bit of time just building rapport and imitating the child. So we might do what they do. And there's actually a lot of power in this early imitation of the actions of the young child with autism. And a lot of research to show that if we start by imitating their actions, it's a really powerful way to get the children to imitating adults and interventionists. So we might begin just by saying, hey, what you know how to do already is super cool and interesting, and I'm just here to help you with your goals and to do what you do. And so that's might be how we start therapy, but it's not where we want to stay. It's really just a starting point to create some rapport, show the child that we're not here to totally change their whole world up, that we're here to support them, and understand that they have some power and some voice as well. And then use that as like a starting point to then slowly start to change and shape the intervention. And so it might be that that's what we do in the very beginning. And then over time, we try to decrease the amount of time that we're engaging in that. And if it's something that helps with a transition, that might be more tolerable in the beginning. Like, okay, you get to do that during your transition, since we know that's something that can be hard. And then again, over time, trying to fade that out. So we're always thinking about this overtime approach. You know, maybe we've gotten the child to the point where they're not only engaging in stereotypy, but they can now do maybe even a brief joint activity routine. That's great. That's progress. So now can we extend that joint activity routine a little bit? So always thinking about, are we seeing incremental progress? And if so, then great. Now we need to make sure we're staying on that track.
Does the ESDM address problem behavior in children with autism? For example, we ask the child to show us where is big train, but he throws everything away or refuses to cooperate.
Yeah, so problem behavior in the ESDM is managed primarily just like you would in most other interventions. So similar to discrete child teaching. Again, this is where we take a lot of those principles from applied behavior analysis. I will say that with just using ESDM as intended, we do see over time a lot of problem behaviors start to just fade away. I think because of the approach that we take to teaching and learning, children tend to be pretty motivated and engaged. We're using the materials that they like. We're using their interest to dictate therapy and what we should be doing. So we tend to see a lot of problem behavior dissipate just with using ESDM intervention as intended, but that of course is not always the case. And when that's not the case, we start to address problem behavior in a similar way to what we would think about in any other intervention. So we'll start with doing a functional behavior analysis, which is really just starting to collect some data to determine the function of that behavior. So the why is the child engaging in this behavior? What is it getting for them? So in the example you just gave, it sounds like the child is eloping when a demand is placed. They're escaping that behavior. So then we start to develop an intervention to essentially combat that function. So if the function is escape, we try to ensure that when a demand is placed, the child is not able to escape that demand. So that might mean the first thing we do is make the request a little bit easier or a little bit more tolerable for the child. So maybe big is just not a concept they understand. It's too hard. I'm out of here when you ask that to me. So maybe I start with a simpler question, something that's more in their repertoire. Or maybe big isn't something that's challenging for the child. They just don't like to respond. Some kids are very sensitive to demands. So maybe we use a prompt, make sure that they're successful, and then we celebrate, and then we don't give another demand for a little bit of time so that it doesn't feel so challenging. So we're always figuring out the function of that behavior, how to respond based on that function, and then implementing that intervention, taking data to ensure that that intervention was correct, that it's working, that we're reducing that problem behavior, and continuing intervention as the data dictates until it seems like we're starting to see a decrease in that problem behavior.
And is it important to work at the table during ESDM therapy?
That's a really good question. I think that ESDM is a little flexible in that regard. We see a lot of our therapists and staff working just kind of on the floor, which is what I did a lot of when I was implementing ESDM as a therapist, lots of time on the floor. A table most certainly could be appropriate. It does add a little bit of structure, and I don't see it as really outside of being appropriate for ESDM because children are going to transition into preschools and kindergartens where they will be spending a lot of time at the table. And so it seems like it's something that we can do to prepare our children for moving into classrooms. But it certainly isn't a prescribed part of the intervention where you need to be at a table. I think of it more as, where would these activities normally be taking place for a child of this age? So something like a snack or Play-Doh, those I think would be kind of naturally occurring at tables. But maybe we're doing a chase game where we're getting up and that we're moving around. Or maybe there's a game where we're playing with like little people, and that might be more just in a play corner of the house, on the floor, on a carpet. So I think it's more about what is the activity and where would a neurotypical child be engaging in that activity. If it's at a table, great. But if it's not at a table, we want to have that flexibility to be engaging wherever, whatever the natural environment for that skill would be. But if it's helping, if a table is one of the structured supports that gets a child learning, then by all means, work at a table. That's great. If we're seeing progress, then that's what we want to be doing.
How do you incorporate ESDM in self-care? So how do you develop self-care using ESDM?
Yeah, so the self-care, the personal independence is one of those domains I spoke about earlier that we assess for the treatment goals. So it's an important piece of the intervention and something that we definitely don't want to ignore. We know that for children with ASD, developing those self-care skills can be a little bit more challenging. So it's important that we assess those areas and determine the need areas for young children with ASD and then start to implement our work in that. So that can be one of the areas where we really look to families for their support. There's some self-care goals that make a lot of sense to incorporate into a treatment session. Snack or meal time is something that we do a lot of. And that all depends on what the child's goals are. So maybe it's learning to drink from an open cup. Maybe it's learning to use a spoon or a fork, or even eat in a structured meal time. Some kids have just free access to food, and we're trying to change that a little bit and make it be more a structured meal time at the table. So it's all determined by what their goals are. But if it's something that makes sense to incorporate into a session, the therapist will try to make sure that we incorporate that. But it's wonderful when families join us for that, because mealtime is something they're going to be working on multiple times a day. So if they learn how to incorporate all of these teaching strategies inside mealtime with their children, that's going to mean that there's so many more times throughout the day that there's learning opportunities occurring. And so we try very hard for these personal independence goals to bring the families into those opportunities, teach them the skills that we're using so those can be incorporated at home. Sometimes it's a goal that really doesn't make much sense for it to be something done inside a treatment session. That can be something like getting dressed or taking a bath, washing hair, tolerating, you know, washcloth on the body, things like this. And in that case, we'll do our best to coach the parents on the strategies that we would try. And then every session, we'll be checking in with the parents. How did it go last night? And be kind of troubleshooting with the families to help determine things that we can try differently to work on ensuring that success. But it should absolutely be a part of the intervention. Like I said before, even if it's just an hour a week, there should still be at least one, if not more, personal independence goals. Because it's something that even from a young age, we want to be starting to target.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just think about the feeding problems or toilet training. I think the most trickiest one. So in this case, parents mostly are included in the process of the development of this kind of skills.
Yes. Yep, absolutely. And feeding as long as it's relatively simple. If it gets a bit more complex, we might ask a feeding specialist or an mm-hmm. OT or an SLP, someone with more expertise to join us in that. But if it's more just like they're a little bit picky or they're just learning the process, then totally appropriate inside the context of ESDM. And then same for toileting. We do a lot of support with teaching toilet training. And that's definitely something that we can focus on in intervention. But like I said, a lot of that is going to take place outside of session time. And so the way to ensure the quickest progress and the most progress is to help the family learn and understand what we're doing so that the child's continuing that process outside of therapy time mm-hmm. and can continue to learn that skill.
Yeah, and I know that sometimes parents are not included in the therapy sessions. So what is the role of the parents and how important is them to participate in the sessions, or when do you include them in the session?
Yeah, for ESDM, we tend to think that parents are a very, very important part of the therapy. And in general, we don't want to exclude the parents really at all. So we leave it mostly up to the families, how much they're able to join for the sessions and what makes sense. It's very varied because every family is so different in terms of who the caregivers are, who is at work, how much time is available, are there other kids? And so we want to be really realistic in understanding that family life is busy and varied and hectic. And sometimes there is only so much time that can be given to joining intervention. But we certainly believe that, you know, we are just a part of what is happening for the family. And where our role is really to support the family in learning these strategies for their child. And so we really don't want to exclude them if it's something where they want to be included, because they're such an important part of continuing therapy and continuing these strategies outside of our treatment time. And with their involvement and support, we're going to see the child learning to generalize their skills, perform their skills with other people, learn their skills much more quickly. And the parent's going to feel a lot more empowered because they understand how to help their child learn. And it isn't this setup where when I take my child here, they can learn. And then when I take them home, I don't know what to do with them anymore. And so we're really wanting to not create that scenario where it feels like we're the secret to the child's learning and the parent is not. That's not to say that there aren't times where the child's very, very attached to the parent and it can be difficult to get any learning to take place. And so we might work with the parent with things like, I just need to build some rapport with your child, but the message should never be, you're not a part of intervention. It's more just, this is what we need to do short term so that we can get into this learning phase. But as soon as it's available, you'll be brought right back into the intervention. And when that is the case, I really like to have a lot of check-in with the family, make sure that they still feel in the know about what we're doing and that they understand why that decision is being made short term. So explaining that rationale and still conveying that idea that you are an important part of this therapy. But right now your child is so attached to you, which is great, but we can't do any teaching yet. Sometimes it might be the case where we start therapy off by coaching the parent. Great. He's only attached to you, not me. Let's see what we can get done just through coaching you. But these are clinical decisions that we'll need to make. And they're so varied based on the family, but really families are a super, super, super important part of ESDM. They're the heart of what we're doing. And we consider parents being involved to the extent that they're available, a really crucial piece. And when we're doing ESDM here, families are always getting at least an hour every other week. So 2 hours a month of parent coaching, where we're really, the idea is to teach them the intervention strategies and then give them time to implement them. So we'll teach a new strategy, set up the family with an activity, and then have them practice implementing that strategy with a little bit of coaching from us. Again, so that they can go home and be continuing on their child's therapy when they're not in session.
Yeah, it's great. And we also started to use online direct watching. For example, if we see that in the beginning of the program, a child can't cooperate with the specialist, we just please a parent to wait a little bit when we establish cooperation, but they can watch online through the WhatsApp application, for example, what's happening, how we do this. It helps too, because it builds trust with the parents and the specialist, so they see what we are doing there.
Yes.
Nicely.
I love that. I love that. Especially with a two-year-old, I totally understand that it's like, what do you mean I can't watch my kid? They're two. But if we need to be able to have some time with a child to build that rapport, to be able to start teaching, I love when the parent can at least still see what's going on. That's such a you know, you can't really separate the two-year-old from the parent at that stage. So nice that they're able to see what we're doing, see that it's fun, see that we're, you know, working on rapport. And I think that helps to put the parents at so much more ease than when they can't see what's being done with their young child who maybe has communication challenges. And so it's really nerve-wracking to not know what's happening with their child. So I love that idea. Some clinics have like two-way mirrors or cameras have been a great way to support that. And then always letting families know that this is temporary until we have enough, we call it instructional control, to be able to teach the child in your presence. Usually it doesn't take super, super long, although every kid is so different. It's hard to predict, but it's nice if we can let the families know, hopefully this is short term and, you know, we want you back in there too. We just, otherwise no teaching's happening. And then what are, you know, what are we doing?
Yeah. And what do you think, can parents use ESDM by themselves, maybe after going through the advanced training, for example? Or they still need supervision from a specialist?
Yeah, we have some really nice research to show that parents can learn to implement ESDM at Fidelity and through parent coaching alone, start to see some really nice outcomes for children. So parents can absolutely learn to use the model, learn to use the model well, and start to see some really nice outcomes and progress for children. I think for anyone, it's really nice if we have someone to check in with. So if there is a professional, I mean, for all of us, right? We reach a point where we're like, oh, don't know how to handle this problem. So it's always nice if there's someone to troubleshoot with. But even if that's not available, we have some really nice evidence to support that children or parents can learn to implement ESDM. And just like there's that blue manual that is all about using the ESDM for therapists, there's a yellow orange manual that's all about how parents can learn to implement the model with their children. So we don't have any results of just using the book alone. It's using the book and parent coaching from someone who knows the model and then seeing really nice outcomes for parents when they're getting parent coaching, but nothing else.
Okay. So you said that you plan advanced training in Latvia in autumn. Maybe you can give some more information if you have for now.
Yeah, there's nothing much more than that just yet. But if anyone is interested in learning more about the ESDM, my biggest dream and my biggest hope is to help make this model more accessible to people worldwide. I think it's so important that we're disseminating this work. I think it offers such a really nice approach for young children with ASD. And like I said earlier, it's important that we have a few tools in our toolkit, because some children are going to learn really well from discrete child teaching and some children aren't. And we want something to offer all of our children so that we're, you know, adapting to meet the needs of everyone. And so my hope was that sometime in October to be able to offer over Zoom the advanced ESDM training course. So a prerequisite to that is taking the introductory course, which is available online. You can do that self-paced. It's available in English and Russian. And you can go to esdm.co and sign up for that introductory course. The dates aren't set yet, but sometime in October, my hope is to host an online course. And in that course, we'll meet six times over Zoom, 2 hours each time, and go through all of the steps of the advanced workshop, which since COVID, we've been able to adopt to being able to give remotely. You will have to have a young child with ASD that you work with in some capacity and the ability to upload videos, because we're going to be doing a checklist, writing objectives, and then practicing those joint activity routines, uploading those, and then in the workshop, we'll be watching them and giving feedback to improve your intervention. So if anyone is interested, I would be happy to discuss more over email or whatever avenue works best. I just really, if people are interested in this model, I really want to be able to disseminate and share it.
Yeah, and also the question, if a specialist or parent went through the introduction course some time ago, for example, 4 years ago or 5 years ago, as I did, can he still be in advanced training in Latvia and Russia?
Yes.
Or he needs to take one more time?
I would suggest one more time. So the introductory course is good for 3 years. So if it's been upwards of 3 years, we do suggest doing it again. Affordable online and it is self-paced, but it's really difficult. That's such a big model. I mean, that introductory course is upwards of 8 hours. So there's so much information to try and retain it 5 years later is a bit challenging. So we do suggest that you retake that course. And then I'm also happy to work with folks through certification if that's something that is of interest to anyone to be certified in the model.
Okay, so anyone can take an introduction course in the website in English, for example, and then he can take any advanced training in Latvia, Russian, or no matter where.
Yes, correct.
Okay, and then he needs to take his certification during the 2 years.
Yep, so you have from after the introductory course, you have 2 years to start the advanced course. And following that, you have 2 years to complete certification. So it is a very long time. I do suggest moving quicker if you are interested, because it just helps with the retention of all those ideas. But yeah, we do offer quite a bit of time because we know life needs that oftentimes.
Yeah, I missed this 4 years. I was like, oops, okay, I will take another trial. Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you have some more words to say to families who raise children with autism?
Yeah, it can be so challenging and scary in the beginning, especially when first receiving that diagnosis. But I have so many years of experience now to say that children with autism can make some really tremendous gains and progress and have some really, really nice outcomes. And I've also really come to see autism as, I don't want to say this in any way to belittle the challenge and the struggle and the heartbreak that can come with knowing that your child is going to be different than expecting, but I've also seen so many children with autism who just have the most beautiful gifts and the most beautiful personalities. And I feel like my whole world and life and experience on this earth has been made better by interacting and meeting people with autism and just seeing the strengths and the beauty in thinking differently and approaching life differently. And it's done so much for my own perspective and understanding. And, you know, while I believe in intervention because I want every individual to be able to have the most access to their own life possible, I don't think of intervention as changing someone, because I do see autism as a gift and something that's beautiful and not something I necessarily want to take away or remove, but something I want to ensure that we're reaching every individual's fullest capacity. And that's mm-hmm. something that I've really come to believe is totally possible for children with autism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for good words. Yes, it's important to hear. Okay, thank you so much for your experience and knowledge. I think you know everything by heart because you're like say everything about the ESDM, but that's great. Yes, thank you so much.
In many years. Thank you so much. It's so nice to see you again.